Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Lauren Mayhew is an American singer, DJ, actress, and content creator. She has toured the US, South Africa, Belgium, Holland, Dubai, and Tokyo. Lauren has also starred in Showtime's Dexter, CSI, Law & Order, Fox's 911, NBC's Blacklist, and most recently CBS's FBI Most Wanted. Lauren was previously signed to Epic Sony and toured as an opening act with Britney Spears, Katy Perry, Destiny's Child, and opened for Aerosmith at the Super Bowl. As a songwriter, Lauren has licensed over 250 original songs to film, television, and commercials. Previously, Lauren toured the globe as the ring announcer and national anthem singer for WWE's SmackDown. She was also an on-air host for Access Hollywood, was the only female resident DJ for TAO Group in New York City at Marquee and Laval for 2 years. Lauren has also headlined at Park MGM and Virgin Casino in Vegas. She just finished as the celebrity DJ for Virgin Voyages this past year, touring through Mexico, Dominican Republic, the Bahamas, and Key West. Lauren's musical vibe is vocal house, tropical, tribal, Brazilian bass, disco house, and old school jams remixed to house music. While DJing, she also sings melodies to her energetic, sultry tracks. Lauren has appeared in a large variety of newspapers, online magazines, TV press outlets, etc., such as DJ Mag, Out Now Magazine, TBBW Magazine, and NBC Daytime. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Lauren Mayhew. Where are you in the world and how are you doing?
Right now, I'm currently in Florida. And it is beautiful and sunny outside. It was raining this past weekend, but now it is cleared up and it is gorgeous out. So loving the weather currently.
Okay, now let's rewind. You've had multiple pies or fingers in different pies in the entertainment world, in different elements. So I'm going to touch on each element as we progress. But at what age did you think, cool, I want to be in this world, this wacky entertainment world that there is? And how did that journey accumulate to where we are currently?
I guess I started acting and singing probably around the age of 9 or 10. So living in Florida, in Tampa, I was pretty close to Orlando where there was a lot of like WB and Nickelodeon TV shows and commercials and things like that that shot there. So as a kid, I was on a TV show called The Reppies that I shot 64 episodes of. It was on PBS. And then I started going with my family on family vacation trips to New York. And when I ended up booking on one of the trips, I ended up getting a series regular role on a soap opera called Guiding Light. And so, you know, my parents were incredibly, incredibly supportive. And so just instead of, you know, they treated basically my acting as if it were soccer practice or gymnastics or anything else like that. And so my mom would travel with me and I probably went back and forth from to New York to Florida, probably at least 4 times a month. So that was a lot. I have to say it got a lot easier once I was in college because I ended up moving from Florida to LA. And for the first time, I was actually in the city that I needed to be working in. So that definitely made it easier in that sense.
Okay. And then what were the next steps from there?
Right. Okay. So once I moved to LA, I still continued acting and singing. I was in a bunch of different TV shows and feature films. So everything from Dexter to CSI to Law and Order. I was in American Pie band camp, did this movie with Hilary Duff called Raise Your Voice. And then even when I graduated college, I did about a year-long stint as the ring announcer and national anthem singer in the WWE, which was also crazy, totally different than anything I had done before. And it was kind of after that point when I finished doing the WWE stuff that I started DJing. So DJing is what came last. And I started playing out first in LA and in San Francisco and just other places around California. And it kind of blew up from there. I think that some people, when they looked at my resume, and saw all these different places that I'd performed at, you know, like the Super Bowl and things like that. That was with my girl band when I was a singer. So I think that I got a lot of opportunities that luckily, because I was ready and prepared, just, you know, came out of the gates, you know, swinging and nailed it with my first couple performances. And so I got a lot of opportunities when I first moved to New York to perform at really big, massive nightclubs right out of the gate as a DJ. So I was really the only female DJ resident at the time for Lavvo and Marquee, which are arguably two of the largest clubs in New York. So that was really cool. And I'm actually like the move from LA to New York was really interesting because obviously there's so much acting and music and things like that that go on, you know, in LA. But I have to say that moving to New York was a really good choice for me because not only did the DJing career take off, but I also booked a really awesome, TV show. I was the main voice and singing voice for, Val Thundershock. She's an animated troll on Trollstopia. So if you're familiar with the DreamWorks feature films that star Justin Timberlake
Yep.
and Anna McKendrick, I booked one of the starring roles in the TV show spinoff that has been airing on Hulu and Peacock for 7 seasons. So that was really cool. What a dream job. Sadly, it just came to an end, but I'd been doing that for the last 7 seasons. So it was a lot of fun.
Okay, so many questions. I'm so excited to unpack all of this. I'm like, yay! So are you still equally dividing your time between acting, DJing and singing?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I'd say it depends. You know, obviously, if I'm filming a TV show or recurring on something or filming something, you know, maybe the music stuff is put on hold for a second. But to be honest with you, it kind of works out scheduling wise because most of my DJ events are nighttime or on the weekends, and then most of my acting stuff is during the week. So I have to say that, like, I'm not saying that it never overlaps or it never conflicts, like, because sometimes it does, but usually, more often than not, it doesn't actually because they're kind of different schedules, if you will. So they've really worked pretty well hand in hand together, I have to say.
Okay, now we're going to focus on the acting. When you mentioned Guiding
Okay.
Light, I got so excited because we never got Guiding Light in South Africa, but we got Days of Our Lives, Bold and Beautiful, all the, I had
Okay.
my Soap Opera Digest magazine subscription until recently.
Did.
I don't know
Oh, I
if
was
you,
in a bunch of those.
what do you enjoy about acting?
You know, I think there's a couple things. One, I think that it's really interesting and fun to be able to walk in someone else's shoes and try to kind of understand what similarities you have to a certain character and how you can kind of, you know, draw on those past experiences in your own life to kind of make this new character come to life. So I think that's really fun. The other thing that I think is amazing is that when you're on a in a feature film or in a TV show, you're just one piece of this massive machine. You know, there's a huge lighting department. There's, you know, a cinematography department. There are the other actors. There's the director. There's the editors. And I think it's really phenomenal to, you know, kind of bring your essence and your work to a project, but then see the final product as a whole, and what you've kind of done as a team. I think that is a really magical, very cool thing, to be able to see like that final product.
The difference between being a se series regular or having an arc in a series, potentially being recurring, and then being a guest, a one-off guest on an episode, what are the
Yeah.
differences for you? Do you find it more difficult doing one or the other, or is it just equally just embracing the character?
So that's actually a really good question. So it's interesting because when you're coming on to a TV show, for example, that's been on the air for, let's say, like, you know, 4, 5, 6 seasons or years, this crew and this cast, they're like a tight-knit family. So sometimes coming on as just, you know, a one day or, you know, as a couple day guest star or something like that can, you know, it can be a little not difficult, but it can be interesting because if they're so close, you know, it's kind of like finding you know, your spot, if you will, and kind of like finding like what you're bringing to the table and how you work with these other individuals. I think it's kind of fun because it always keeps it interesting and it keeps you on your toes. I think that the same thing also happens with a feature film as well. You kind of form like this little family bond, but then in my experience, I feel like it's always over before you know it. So I feel like right when I'm like, oh, I love like coming to work every day and seeing these people and whatever, I'm like, oh my God, now I only have a week left. So that tends to happen, but it's really interesting because certain sets and that I've been on for different TV shows have been a lot easier, I feel like, to kind of infiltrate and become a part of the framework, I guess, if you will. And other ones are maybe a little more challenging. So it really just kind of depends, I feel like, on the atmosphere that is on the set already.
The ones that are easier compared to challenging, is it the atmosphere or the energy, or what is the difference for you that it makes it more challenging?
Well, I think just like, just when you meet people in real life, whether it's a co in any industry, whether it's a coworker, or whether it's a, there's certain people that you just gel with and
Okay,
connect
got
with
it.
more instantaneously. And you never really know that until you're there and you're in the moment. And each set, the overall vibe and energy and atmosphere of a set can be totally different, like set to set, and depending. So I think that that's created not only by the actors and by by the different people working behind the scenes, but also I think it's maybe as an individual actor, the energy that you bring to that. I try to be very respectful of what they kind of have already going on, and like how everyone has like a different way of when they want to block and how they collaborate together and all these sorts of things. So, but I'd have to say though, on a lot of the procedural shows, they are very used to having multiple guest stars because they have a ton of guest stars every single week because they're kind of telling a new little vignette or story within the bigger arc, like the longer story. So I think, a lot of them, depending on the series, are more used to having a ton of guest stars.
Now, going back to soaps, I'm a huge proponent for the soaps. I cheer them on. And a lot of people think, whatever. But soap actors work damn hard, learn so many scripts, memorize it. Did you feel having that foundation and that boot camp, so to speak, allowed you, propelled you to tackle many other elements in the entertainment world?
For sure. I mean, it's definitely being a soap actor is very different than most other acting, I'd say, film or TV or otherwise, because it's churn and burn. You're doing a new episode every single day. So just like you said, you are learning an insane amount of copy. So definitely in terms of, root like memorization skills, like for sure that was incredibly helpful. Also, too, you're having to remember a lot of things. Because you're not doing it as many times. Like they don't usually like turn around and do different camera angles. They're shooting all of the camera angles kind of at once. So it's almost like stage acting, or theater in that way where you have to kind of remember to like turn out and cheat and stuff like that a little bit. Because instead of shooting the scene multiple times and then just changing the camera angles or rearranging the world, they shoot it all at once. So you really have to be aware of not only your blocking, but also your eye line and where the other cameras kind of are in the space. So I'd say it requires you to have just a lot more awareness than maybe you would need to have in other film and TV, if that makes sense.
Now, coming off of a soap where they do an episode a day, and then going into a television and movies where they repeat the scenes from different angles and that, did you ever find, because you had that speed and knowledge of that speed, did you ever find that other elements a little bit, I wouldn't say boring, but a little bit frustrating. It's like, okay, I'm doing this again.
Actually, no, because for me, I think that you can get a lot more nuance and a better performance when you're kind of like just focusing on that one thing. And when you know, like, okay, this is what the framing is, it's going to be, waist up or just super close on my face, et cetera. I think that it helps you as a performer be able to like just be able to focus on like, oh, okay, this is what the purpose of this shot is. So I think that that's actually kind of helpful. The only way that I would say that it's kind of difficult sometimes is especially if it's a very, very emotional scene. I've had situations where the director has shot the wide shots first and then they punch in for the close-ups. And it's hard sometimes if you've been like crying and crying and crying or like yelling at the top of your lungs or whatever to kind of continue to have to muster up that same emotion over and over again, especially when the last few takes are the ones that are like directly close up on your face. Sometimes that can be very hard for an actor just because it's hard to get to that emotional place again and again and again. So I've had that happen before where they're like, now punch in, and I'm like, oh shit, we haven't done the close-ups yet.
Crying as an actress or as an actor, how do you is do you I know each actor has a different way of doing it, but how do you tap into that?
So for me now, it's a much, much easier Tool. I think that the more life experience that you have and just the more things that you've gone through in life, like allow you, there's certain things that you know that are trigger points for you, or that would be that were really difficult memories for you that even just thinking about them, you know, can start eliciting sort of, you know, certain emotions and things like that. And then I start just allowing myself to feel those feelings.
Okay.
And then a lot of times, especially if the script is well written, the words that are coming out of your mouth are usually something that makes sense for the character. You know, they're vulnerable or they're hard to say. I don't mean hard in the sense of like, I mean hard like that it's hard to, you know, it'd be a hard thing for anyone, any human
Got it.
being, to say these words to another person because it's like a, you know, an intimate or vulnerable or scary thing is what I'm saying. And so that kind of combination and just looking another person in the eye and having to say that, I feel like it just comes. Now, it's
Okay.
interesting that you asked this, though. As a kid, I feel like it was a lot harder for me. I feel like that was the hardest thing. And I feel like as a kid, you know, there's always these crying scenes and stuff like that. And I felt it was a lot harder for me when I was younger, but mainly because I was really lucky to have, you know, a pretty great childhood with parents who loved me and, you know, and I was just a happy kid. So I think it was much harder for me then to kind of tap into that just because I hadn't had as many, you know, really sad or difficult experiences in life. Whereas now I've lived so much more life, I definitely have a lot more to draw on. So I think that it's become easier simply because, you know, I've gone through more stuff.
Now, being a voice artist, for example, you mentioned the Troll Show. What is it like being that voice artist of being the voices, not knowing how it's going to turn out, and then seeing it? Well, there's a huge difference, obviously, between that and being in front of the camera.
Like I do know what it's going to look like
Oh,
because
okay.
they have what's called like they have it what's called like an enigmatic, and so I can kind of watch like parts of the scene and stuff, like, or just like
Ooh.
it's not like the full 3D version of the drawing, but it's like a, you know, like a sketch, if you will.
Okay.
So I can kind of get a sense of like maybe what the world is going to look like. I obviously already know what my character and the other characters look like, so I have some semblance of an idea. But they do then finally animate to my voice. So like I do the voice first, and then they animate. But then sometimes we have to maybe change things for legal or just change certain dialogue because maybe the episode is running a little long, or maybe they just felt like a certain joke didn't work, so they want to change it for another thing. So then they'll have these kind of like series of beeps. I'll be like visually walk be like watching the animation, but also listening to these beeps, and then I'll hear what I did before, and then I'll try to kind of similarly match the tone and feeling and emotion, while changing whatever the tweak is in the dialogue that needs to be tweaked or changed or whatever. So, that definitely takes a little bit of getting used to. I'd say that I may, have caught on to it slightly faster than maybe some other voiceover actors, only because as a singer, I'm used to having to double my own vocals to punch in and like, you know, re-record something or match something that I've already done because, you know, I'm trying to do that same vocal, but as a harmony, like a higher harmony or a lower harmony or octave or something like that. So I feel like I've just had more practice in terms of being able to mimic my own performance and what I've already done. So that was definitely like a helpful tool, I guess I could draw from to help myself while being in there. But I have to say the producer of the show, he, Matt Bean, he was absolutely phenomenal. Like working with him, all the other actors that were a part of it, they're so talented. Like it gives you so much to work with and so much to draw from. He would always usually let me do my version first and kind of see what I naturally brought to the character.
Okay.
And then if he had other ideas, he would be like, oh, why don't you try it like this? Or, you know, what if you know, kind of look at it this way or whatever. And sometimes it would be a way that I would never have thought of, like something, and I was like, oh wow, like that does actually bring like a new comedic element to it or gives it somewhere else to go. So it's really great to work with people that not only have a vision for the overall like kind of final product, but that allow you to play and
Yeah.
create and kind of come up with your ideas as well. So it was a really collaborative, really positive experience.
Okay, so you referenced the singing, so let's dive into that world that you the next pie of your fingers. You mentioned a group, so what group were you in, and are you doing solo stuff now? Let's cover your musical journey.
Sure. So when I was younger, I got signed to Epic Sony, and I was in a girl band, and we opened up for Britney Spears, NSYNC, Destiny's Child, 98 Degrees. We got to do the Super Bowl, which was amazing, with Sting and Styx doing the pregame. Man, it was an absolute dream and whirlwind. I got signed with three of my best friends. So we weren't like one of those manufactured groups. All three girls, and then including myself, can all really, really sing. And we would just bust out in harmony, basically for anyone who would listen. But it was such a dream and a treat to be able to travel all over the country and all over the world with them. You know, it's interesting now performing as a solo artist, either as a DJ or as a singer, because, you know, growing up, I was actually so used to performing with other people on stage with me. I think that's why when I first started doing my solo thing and I had a band, it was kind of fun for me because I was used to vibing off of someone else and drawing off of their energy and giving them my energy and having these kind of inside jokes and, you know, all of that sort of that thing, which was very, very different for me with the DJ world, where it's just me up there by myself doing my thing, which is still very fun, but also interesting because you are the sole person bringing the energy to the crowd. So that was definitely a little bit different for me and took a little bit of getting used to. But that's also another reason why I love to sing when I DJ, because it allows me just that extra kind of step of being able to connect with the audience and, you know, kind of vibe with them. So sometimes, depending on the stage setup and everything, I'll come out from behind the booth and like dance with the audience and sing directly with them, et cetera. But I have to tell you, it's definitely very complicated holding the mic and then having to come back and switch the songs. And it's a lot of things going on at once. But definitely a lot of fun. So yeah, that's definitely, I'd say, something that took a little bit of getting used to, with performing as a solo artist.
What was the band's name?
Oh, sorry. The band was called PYT, Pretty Young Things, like the Michael Jackson song. So we were signed to Epic Sony. We were signed to the same label as Michael Jackson. And yeah, we had found this contest in a magazine saying, "Become a pop diva." And we were like, "This sounds awesome." We were 12 years old. We were like, "Yeah, we want to be a pop diva. This sounds like a blast." So we just recorded a song and submitted it. And before we had a chance to even submit it to the contest, a director of a group that we were singing in Florida, knew two A&R guys, at Epic Sony, and they had said that they were looking for, you know, the next big girl group, big, you know, whatever thing. And she was like, "You know what? I actually had these girls. They're kind of on the younger side, but I think that you would love them. They're crazy talented." And so a day or two later, they flew down to Florida. We met with them, and within a week from conception to getting signed, it literally took a week. And then we were recording and out on tour with Britney Spears, I think not even a month later. So it was, I mean, so quick.
How long did you guys stay together for?
About 4 years. So from about 12 or 13, we were all around 12 or 13 when we started, and we were all around 16, 17 when we left the band. You know, I was the only one who was acting and doing other stuff prior to the group. And I have to say, I did miss a lot of the acting. It's interesting because back then, the music industry and the film and TV industry didn't really work as well together. Like, I think that, you know, Sony kind of saw all my acting stuff as kind of a distraction. Like, they just wanted me to be out on tour 24/7 or working on my next album or, you know, in dance rehearsals or whatever it was. Whereas nowadays, I feel like it's totally different. Like, if a label could have one of their artists be on a TV show, they would love it. And vice versa, if a TV show had an actor that then was going to go off on tour and perform, they would love that or whatever as well. I feel like they look at it now as it's just bringing more eyeballs, bringing more attention to, you know, the project. And I feel that, you know, those sorts of performers are looked at more of as a brand, you know, today, rather than just a singer or are you an actor? Like, it's so interesting to me back in the day how everyone wanted to force me to be in one box or the other. I'm like, I know this is mind-boggling, but I do both things. So
But now I've
it
got,
was just crazy.
and this is maybe a controversial question, but do you not maybe think that singers these days maybe cross-pollinate or cross-move into different genres is because the royalties in streamings are not, oh, and the royalties are not as good, and they may you guys' main income comes from touring, so it's another avenue of income to bring in because of what's happening with the digital world.
I mean, that's interesting to point out. Yes, I mean, that definitely could be a factor. I think to me, it's maybe more so a factor of, nowadays with everyone being able to, have like their own home studio, with where it's reasonably priced. I mean, it's still expensive to get nice mics and to soundproof a room and all of these other things, but it's much more reasonable nowadays than I feel like it used to be. And also because of the internet and because of the ability to send, like large files and, share sessions and things like that, I feel like it's opened up these markets where you're not only exposed to maybe different types of music and producers and DJs that you maybe never would have worked with before, but now it's possible to work with them when you're not even in the same room with them. You can send sessions back and forth, you can collaborate. I've had multiple releases with DJs and producers I've never met in real life.
Oh, wow.
And that wasn't really a thing back in the day. So I feel that on one hand, everyone is just being exposed to so much more music. I think that's one factor. I think another factor is, a lot of people have different musical likes. Like just because you love dance music doesn't mean that you can't also love funk and jazz or soul or something else. So I feel that, it can get a little confusing if you're releasing under a single artist name and you're doing all of these different types of sounds. So I think that it's very common nowadays for artists to maybe have like a side project where they go by a different name and release like a totally different vibe or sound of music that also really fulfills them and makes them feel like they're getting to express themselves creatively in that genre or in that lane as well, while also not I guess tainting the image or the genre and the kind of feel and vibe they already have for their solo artist project or whatever. So I think it, for all of those reasons, and maybe honestly the reason that you mentioned as well, like it's true, being able to have as many revenue streams as possible is always a plus. I feel that it's really difficult these days because I used to do a lot of music licensing where I'd license songs to TV shows, national commercials, feature films, all these different things. And it is so incredibly confusing, to know how to collect the money that you're owed. Like, first of all, every single country has, its own pro association. So you, and in each country also, and some countries have multiple pro associations, like, with the US having, CSAC and BMI and ASCAP, they have more than one. But the problem is each pro does their accounting and does their like royalty collecting and even does how they fill out all the paperwork completely differently. So it's kind of difficult to be able, when you work with other people, figuring out how to do that and making sure that you're collecting royalties, not just, stateside, but also internationally. When I did a commercial for a Klondike bar, a national commercial with the song that I had. And I remember I was seeing it on TV morning, noon, and night all the time. And about 9 months had gone by and I hadn't gotten a single residual check. And I'm thinking to myself, I know it takes a little while to get residuals, but like it shouldn't be this long. Where is the money at? So I finally called ASCAP and I was like, hey, what's the deal? And they're like, oh, so glad you called. They're like, because we don't collect those for you unless you send us specific codes. I'm like, what codes? They're like, you have to go to this website called Competitrack. You type in, so because it was for a Klondike bar commercial, I typed in Klondike bar. I typed in the name of the song. I typed in Lauren Mayhew. I typed in descriptors about the commercial. And then all of these different commercials came up from Klondike bar. And I had to go through, so tedious, one by one by one by one, see if my song was in it. And then it had a code that went with it. And I had to write this code down
Oh
on a
my.
form and submit ASCAP. I mean, it was that. I'm like, how would anyone ever know this? So I called my other writers. I let them know. I'm like, listen, to be paid, this is what you have to do, and you need to do it now because ASCAP also informed me that I had 3 more months. If I didn't do it within the next 3 months, within that calendar year, residuals would have just been gone. Like I wouldn't have gotten anything, and it was thousands of dollars. So it's just crazy to me. And that's for a commercial that I saw that I knew was out there. Like, what about internet? I don't know that people are using my song for, or what about, if it's playing in a gym or if it's playing, on a, I don't know. There's just so many different places where it can be. There's now companies that you can pay and you give them 10%. It's called like an admin deal where you give them 10% of your royalty so that they can go to all these different countries and track down the money that you're owed. But this is money that you should already be getting paid. It's like, why do you have to pay another person to track down the money that you're already owed? Like it's so ludicrous.
I mean, just listening to you is like, it's like, oh my
Oh.
God. Can you imagine how many people haven't been paid
for multiples of things for thousands of dollars or euros or pounds just because I
Sure,
didn't
for sure.
know any
And
of
then
this.
100%. And then there's people, being honest, like for example, there's some people like they'll do a pub deal, right? Where they work with Sony or Universal Music or something, and they get like an upfront advance. Let's call it like 50, excuse me, like $50,000 or something. And that basically goes towards them to be able to like live and do their thing and write new music. And it's kind of an advance. So like basically once their music starts making money, the label would then take that money back. And then once it's past that initial signing fee, then you start making royalties on top of that. Well, another way to do it is working with independent publishing companies where each publishing company will only take a percentage of a song that they license for you. So if I have a song and let's just say it's called Gone or whatever, and if I license that song, none of these publishing companies get a cent. But if they license it to a commercial or a TV show, then they would get a percentage on that specific license. Now, a lot of these have a time frame of when they're, collecting these residuals for. So I had it just because, I mean, this owner of this company, it was called Crucial Music, was so honest and like forefront. He basically came to me and he said, "Hey, listen, our deal ran out like 2 years ago, but I just got these residuals from like an internet ad that we had done, and technically I'm not supposed to be collecting on your song anymore, but all of your money came to me." He's like, "So what's your updated address? I'll write you a check and send it to you." And that's just because he's such an honest, amazing human. But what about the
Yes.
people that aren't?
Yes, totally.
Yeah, you want to believe that everyone would. But even if it's not, that nefarious, it could just be someone who's not paying as much attention to their bookkeeping and like didn't realize that the contract
Exactly.
had already expired and, just doesn't know and collects the money and is not paying attention to it because they're working with so many different artists. So anyways, long story short, it is just a nightmare collecting money and royalty artists in general. And I feel like the more that I learn about the royalty and licensing game, the more I feel like I know nothing.
So you're referencing songs. I love this game. Now I know if I had to ask this question in 2 minutes, 2 years, 20 hours, I know your answer will be different every time because there are millions of them and I recognize that and I understand that. I'm not saying favorite. I'm think saying
Okay.
top of mind. But if you had to play five songs by other artists once we finish this conversation, what would those five songs be and by who?
Okay, so there are some phenomenal DJs that I love that are not necessarily, I feel like unless you're into the dance scene, the dance music world, like you may or may not know them, but they are just popping off and doing great. So one of them is called Black Caviar. Another one is called Cat Dealers. They're from so Cat Dealers is from Brazil. They're a Brazilian DJ duo. I've actually had a release with them, a song called Hush. And I absolutely think that they're fantastic. Black Caviar is a duo from New York. And they do very like tech house, very like vibey, very different sort of stuff, a lot of like remakes and remixes. There's another artist named Cream, spelled with a K. He's fantastic. And then there's another duo. I don't know why all DJs are duos now these days. It's very common, but they're called You a Side Piece. And low key, I've been like trying to slip into their DMs, being like, "If you need a vocalist, I would really love to work with you guys." So if they see or hear this, I would really love to be a vocalist on one of your tracks. So I love them. Let's see who else. Gosh, Cascade, I've always been a fan of, and Kungs. Both of them do a lot of like tropical sort of house music, which I'm really into. God, there's so many. I think coming up here, I'm going to get the opportunity in New York to open up for Purple Disco Machine. And I love disco house music, and he's basically the OG in disco house. So I'm super stoked to be able to perform with him. He's amazing. There's just so many great.
Cool. So, Lauren, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. So, as a final message, what would you like to say?
I would just like to say thanks so much for listening to the podcast and, supporting my music, and I love talking and hearing from you guys. So feel free to connect with me on social media, on Instagram, or on—I keep wanting to call it Twitter now, even though it's X. It's so weird; I can't get used to it. But I'm Lolo Mayhew on basically all the platforms, except for YouTube and Spotify. I'm under Lauren Mayhew, but I go by either, so whichever you want to call me, Lolo or Lauren.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.